Good afternoon, you tuned to Juno Afternoon here on KTVO FM in Juno and KRNN FM in Juno. Today on a Juno Afternoon, we'll get a preview of tonight's UAS Sound and Motion presentation with members of the Juno-based expedition, A Trip South. We'll find out about the screening of the film Raising of America next Monday. Photographer Annette Smith will be here at the preview for Friday Fireside Lecture at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center about the wreck of the Princess Sophia. And we'll talk with Margie Hamburger about upcoming events at the Juno Douglas City Museum. That writer's almanac, Murder Note Music and More today on a Juno Afternoon. Live at 3 on KTUO, repeated at 4 on KRNN, and available online by KTUO.org. It's a high wind warning until 4 p.m. this afternoon near downtown Juno and Douglas.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A new report says racism is the major reason that Canada's First Nations are getting health care that's below par compared to what non-Aboriginals have access to. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, it also says old government policies are partly responsible for the poor health of the country's First People.
The study called First Peoples Second-Class Treatment suggests that racism in the healthcare system is pervasive. It was released by the Wellesley Institute, a group that researches public health issues. The study suggests that some of the racism comes from healthcare workers who display an unconscious non-Aboriginal prejudice. Many Aboriginal people experience some form of racism from healthcare workers so often that they develop strategies to deal with it before visiting emergency departments, or they avoid getting healthcare altogether. Dr. Janet Smiley is one of the authors of the report.
We do find that a significant proportion of Aboriginal people have experienced like an attack, a verbal or physical attack. But what I think is the way forward is for us to all kind of challenge this faulty logic where we associate negative things about Aboriginal people.
The study also says the disparities in health between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people find their basis in colonial government policies, such as segregation and the Indian residential school system. Smiley and others are recommending solutions for dealing with racism in the healthcare system, including more Aboriginal healthcare workers and cultural safety training for non-Aboriginal healthcare workers. And she says there should be Aboriginal-specific treatment programs by incorporating traditional healing into what many feel is an intimidating hospital setting. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Members of the San Carlos Apache tribe in Arizona are taking part in a two-day march, which began Thursday, to raise awareness and call for protection of an area called Oak Flat Campground. A parcel of Oak Flat is in a land exchange bill included in the National Defense Authorization Act, which was passed and signed into law in December. The bill authorizes a federal land exchange in southeast Arizona for mining development. The grassroots group Apache Stronghold is in opposition. Fernelda Grant, San Carlos Apache Tribal Historic Preservation Officer, is a member of the group.
Oak Flat Campground, in our language as Chichen, which is an area that we use to go harvest acorn, medicinal plant. There are many bands and many people who are still alive who do have connections, who've had connections there for many, many, many years.
Arizona lawmakers say development would create jobs and reduce dependence of foreign resources. But the grassroots group says it's a direct attack on the tribe and says mining will destroy the sacred site and the environment. They're calling on churches, spiritual groups, veterans, and other interested parties to occupy Oak Flat during the All Nation Spiritual Gathering being held Saturday. Ceremonies begin today. The 32nd annual Yukon Quest International Sled Dog Race starts Saturday. Ray Reddington Jr. is the only Alaska Native musher among the 26 teams signed up. The 1,000-mile race starts in the capital of Canada's Yukon Territory, Whitehorse. Reddington is the grandson of Iditarod Sled Dog Race founder Joe Reddington Sr.
You know, everybody asked me if I was running it in honor of him. I run dogs because I like it. And I'm here because I want to be here.
His native roots are from his Inupiaq mother.
Me a native? Yeah, I think it's definitely good to just to have a presence that way. Someone ought to be here, you know.
Over the next 2 weeks, mushers will drive dog teams along the frozen Yukon River, across the Canadian border, and through a handful of small rural villages in Alaska's eastern interior before they cross the finish line in Fairbanks. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation. with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Supported by the Tribal Telecom and Technology Conference, Weaving Pathways Across the Digital Divide. The annual Tribal Telecom Golf Classic will be held May 4, 2015 at the Isleta Eagle Golf Course. Info at tribaltelecomconference.com. The Albuquerque Hispano Chamber of Commerce's Convention and Tourism Department welcomes to Albuquerque the Gathering of Nations to the UNM Pitt April 24th. Information on services and the Gathering of Nations at ahcnm.org. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Time is 6 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau and KRNN FM in Juneau. In the studio with me now are Chris Hinckley and Max Stanley, one of four people who went on the whole trip, a trip south, going from Alaska to Argentina, and it's good to know they made it back, too. 12 people were involved in the whole expedition. And how long did it take you, and when did you go?
Well, it's a complicated question. We all took off here from Sandy Beach on the 1st of June 2012. And there was a group of 12 of us, so it was quite a large group, all friends, all from Juneau. And then there was kind of a core of four of us, me, Chris Hinckley, Max Stanley, Kanan Bosler, and Andrew Flansos, who continued the rest of the way by bicycle. And then we had other friends come and visit us through different sections, or we also met up with different cyclists and kind of, so our group was always fluctuating. Could be four sometimes, could be six, could be eight, could be ten. Kind of the more the merrier. But it took us, and then we all kind of ended the trip at different times too, and if we had known how many times and how complicated to answer this question it would have been, I think we would have just stuck together. But
just answering the question took longer than the trip.
Yeah. So it was about a year and a half journey. Kanan managed to stretch it out to about 2.5 years and everybody in between. So, but yes, it was quite an exciting a journey and lots of stories and good memories. So.
And you're talking about some of the stories tonight at the Sound in Motion at the University of Alaska Southeast.
Yeah.
No, you're not going to do the whole thing. You're going to do the Sea of Cortez part.
Yeah, we're going to focus on the Sea of Cortez because this year for the One Campus, One Book Tour at UAS, they're reading The Log of the Sea of Cortez by John Steinbeck. And we spent a bit of time on the Sea of Cortez, kind of two different sections. One was our first initiation to the Sea of Cortez up around Bahía de Concepción and kind of the central of the peninsula and just enjoying the beautiful beaches and snorkeling and the aquamarine waters. And that's some of the area that Steinbeck went in his log of the Sea of Cortez. And then the second portion that we experienced the sea was crossing from La Paz to mainland Mexico, and so we spent 5 days on a sailboat crossing that, stopped at an island, and had a great time. So we're going to kind of share some of those stories that we had with everyone and connect it back with the Log of Sea of Cortez and some of our experiences.
Now, for those of those who failed geography or forgot it along the way, can you tell me where the Sea of Cortez is?
The Sea of Cortez separates Baja, Mexico from mainland Mexico, and it's the big peninsula that sticks down south of California, and then it's an inland, or it's the sea on the other side of the Pacific of the peninsula.
Why did you go in the first place?
Why did we go to the Sea of Cortez? So why did we go? We went to the Sea of Cortez because it was just, we heard it's a great place going down Baja, Mexico, and you have the Pacific on one side, the Sea of Cortez on the other side, pretty rural. Kanan, one of the guys that biked with us, he kind of thought it was the most wild, the closest place to wilderness bicycling that we had on the whole trip. We'd go sometimes a day or two without seeing a town or only see very few cars passing on the road. So we really wanted to make that a destination on the trip just because we'd heard so much about it.
Along the way, you hitched a ride with a sailboat.
Yes, we did.
And tell me about that, please, because it sounds kind of notable, like, according to your blog.
Yes. There's a ferry service that crosses from La Paz to mainland Mexico, and originally we had thought about doing that, but as we got south on the Baja Peninsula, we started seeing a lot of yachters and cruisers and sailors who cross back and forth or explore around the Sea of Cortez, And so we started talking with them, and we found that it might be possible for us to catch a ride crewing on one of these sailboats. And so we spent a few weeks in La Paz looking for such a ride. And there's a,
and for the whole story, I think you got to come tonight at 7 o'clock, right?
Exactly. Thank you, Chris, for getting ahead of myself.
Now, tell me about a little bit about the book, The Log of the Sea of Cortez.
So I found this pretty interesting and exciting that we were asked to do this presentation at UAS, because I was just saying we were going through some of our slides last night and make sure our presentation was all together, and we found a slide of Max reading a John Steinbeck book, not The Log of from the Sea of Cortez, but another Steinbeck novel, on the sailboat as we were traveling across from La Paz. So this was kind of this really exciting adventure that we were lucky enough to take part in, and we also all read a lot of Steinbeck on the trip. So this particular book is actually a little different than the normal Steinbeck kind of mold. It's a nonfiction book about his journey with another. It's actually supposed to be co-authored with Ed Ricketts, who is more science-based, I would say, as far as his style of writing. But it documents their journey into the Sea of Cortez to log marine life and to kind of just study what was going on under the water in the Sea of Cortez. And they found some really interesting things. And they also and Steinbeck also puts his incredible storytelling voice into that novel. So if you haven't read it, you should. It's quite a read, and yeah, hopefully we can kind of capture a little bit of the Steinbeck storytelling ourselves. We'll try our best.
You've probably been asked this a couple million times, but what kind of an effect does this trip have on your life?
I think we are still every day kind of trying to figure out the effect on our lives. It's kind of I think originally I was thinking, oh, we'll go on this trip and then we'll know some great secret to the world and something like this, right? It'll change our lives. But I think it's just kind of something that's part of us now, and we have this appreciation for traveling and an appreciation for some of these other cultures and countries that are so different than our hometown. So I think for all of us it gave us an incredible appreciation of the world. I think definitely gave us the idea that most people are pretty nice, good, welcoming, loving people. And that's a pretty powerful thing to feel over that long of a time. And in those many foreign places, it could have easily been like, we felt out of place here, we don't speak the language, but people always welcomed us in and helped us along the way. And it was such a powerful experience to see how caring and loving everyone was. So.
And you covered a lot of this in your blog. How did you decide who would write in the blog, or did everybody just take a little bit at a time?
Blog writing was always an interesting time of the month, and it varied back and forth, but we generally co-authored the blog, and so someone would write a section, and someone else would then add a piece, and another person would add a piece, and then we kind of edit it together, and then throw pictures in. It was often a dreaded time because it meant we'd have to sit at a computer for many, many hours, but it was, we're definitely now happy that we did it, and as we were doing it, we're happy that we did it, because now we have that personal record, but then also just being able to share a lot of our stories with people that we met along the way and people back home.
Now, you said you spent a little bit of time, I think, in La Paz before you went on the sailboat,
mm-hmm.
waiting for a ride.
Yes.
How did you decide when to leave a place?
We decided to leave when we were able to find a ride. So
the beauty of our journey was we didn't have to be anywhere at any time. So that's pretty crucial if you're undertaking something of that distance and that magnitude. So we had the flexibility to wait and kind of let the adventure happen instead of having to be to the next town at a certain time. So everything along our entire trip was miraculous how things lined up and kind of worked out for us. I don't know if it could ever happen again like it did to us. So we were pretty fortunate to stumble across the right people. And I think we were also, though, very willing and tried to meet as many people as we could and put ourselves out there and try to see what kind of things could happen. So this trip across the Sea of Cortez is definitely a prime example of an incredible adventure that we didn't see coming and are so happy to have been a part of.
Every time I think of your adventure, I think of your parents at the end of your trip saying, I'm glad they're home. I finally made it.
Yes, that's true. I think we both came home a little early. Kanan tried to stretch it out. I think he was giving his mother a little bit of a heartache.
Plenty of heartache.
Plenty of heartache. But, yeah, we all made it, and I think none of us regret in the least going. So it was quite a time.
Well, I'm not going to ask you any more questions because I want people to go to your talk tonight at 7 o'clock at the Ealing Lecture Hall, the University of Alaska Southeast. I've been talking with Chris Hankley and Mike Stanley about Sea of Cortez and the talk tonight, again, at Strip South, happening at 7 o'clock at the Ealing Lecture Hall. Anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
No, but thanks a lot, Jeff, for having us on the show.
Yeah, we hope to see you all out there tonight, 7 o'clock.
Toda mi inspiración, vamos todos a bailar este sabroso merengón. Vamos todos a bailar este sabroso merengón. Cuando Joaquín Díaz toca, él toca bien sonriente. A todo el mundo le gusta a bailar los canadienses. A todo el mundo le gusta a bailar los canadienses. Con este ritmo sabroso que lo pone bien caliente, con este acordeón sabroso bailan todos los canadienses. Con este acordeón sabroso bailan todos los canadienses.
It's 18 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. My next guests, Andrea Lyon and Kitty Blagden from EYC, talking about a film called The Raising of America, Early Childhood and the Future of Our Nation. It's happening next Monday, February 9th from 5 to 7 p.m. at the 360 Studios at KTUO's building downstairs here. Joy and Kitty, thank you very much for coming down to the station.
Thank you for having
nice
us.
Nice to be here.
So, Joy, first, could you tell me what AEYC is?
AEYC stands for the Association for the Education of Young Children in Southeast Alaska, and we work with our statewide partners, THREAD and Best Beginnings, and to support the health and well-being and early learning for young children in Southeast.
How many kids do you have in your program?
Well, there are about 2,000 children in Juneau and then another 2,000 children all over in Southeast Alaska, so around 4,000 children in our region that are under age 5, and that is the most critical age for, you know, brain development and for the family well-being, getting off to a great start. So we work with the parents and the early childhood programs and then community efforts to bring people together around making our children, you know, the support for them strong.
Tell me about THREAD.
THREAD is a connecting, it's the Child Care Resource and Referral Network for Alaska, so it connects early education for early childhood programs, and it connects parents to find child care programs. You know, often you know where your grade schools are. It's very easy. There's, like in Juneau, 6 elementary schools and the charter school in Montessori. And yet for children under age 5, they're really scattered all throughout the community with a really wide range of what they offer and what the quality is of the program. So we, through THREAD, help connect parents to know what to look for and what questions to ask, and, you know, what, of course, there's very little availability for child care in Juneau right now, but when there are openings, then we keep track of where those openings are.
and you're here to talk about today, the Raising of America.
Yeah, that's right. We're putting on an event with KTOO on Monday, this coming Monday, February 9th. And the Raising of America is a PBS documentary special. And this is the premiere, an hour-long premiere that we are putting on. So that will be the first hour. And then the second hour is going to be an At360 forum with hosted by Lisa Fu and with four panelists.
So the panelists are Jim Calvin from McDowell Group, who will be talking about the economic return on investment that, that we get when we invest early in those early years. It's a 7 to 10% a year return on investment. And that really outdoes the stock market in most years. So, you know, in terms of investment, it's really powerful. And he has great information about that. And then Patrick Sidmore from Alaska Mental Health Board will be a panelist talking about the ACEs study, the adverse childhood experiences, how children are like little sponges, and when there's stress in the home, they're the first to really feel that, and that stress can have, you know, negative consequences later on in their development and learning. And then also Steve Suwing is a really involved dad in the community. He's facilitated a lot of dads groups. He participated in the White House Summit on Working Families. So talking about that balance of work and family and how do you maintain, you know, you really need two working people in a household to make it in Juneau because of the high cost of living here. And so how do we balance all that and still be great parents and support young children?
Now, the Raising of America is not just one time, it's a series.
Yes, so this is the launch, and this is like a preview that's we have the rights to show that, you know, ahead of time before the full broadcast. It'll be later on this year, and so it's an early chance to see this and roll it out.
It's the hour-long premiere, and then there are three other episodes that are each about 20 minutes long. That will be following that. So this is the big grand opening of the first.
It sounds like the Raising of America is more like a show based on science and with science and raising children.
That's right. It really goes into the brain development. There's like 700 synapses a second that are firing off in young children's brains. You know, that it really talks about that early brain development and how important that is for employers, for parents, for policymakers. You know, really, the way that we raise our children impacts all of our lives because it's what is the world going to look like 100 years from now? Well, that really is dependent on how we're raising our children today.
It's a documentary.
That's right. And so we encourage everyone to come because it's going to be really exciting and it's really important information. It's a really, it's a great opportunity. So again, it's, Katie, you want to say the time?
Yeah. It's from 5 to 7 on Monday, February 9th. And, yeah, we really encourage everyone to come. It's going to be a really awesome film. I actually haven't seen this yet, but Joy has, and she said it was really powerful, and I think it'll be a really wonderful opportunity. We're going to have some appetizers, and so it'll be fun.
Joy, to you, what made it powerful?
Seeing that the real stories of the families that are, you know, they go right into the homes of people that are working and trying to get to work, and the breakfast table, you know, the negotiating that goes on. Well, how are we going to pick up the children tonight when I have this meeting and you have this, and you know, and then you can just see the stress in the family, and you know, and then what's exciting is talking about, well, we know what works. We know what the opportunities are. There's so much research on showing the value of investing early, and yet we haven't made that switch. It's like we still have in our minds that children aren't ready to learn until they're 5 years old, when that is totally the opposite of what reality is and what all the research shows. So I think it's having that really concrete, cutting-edge research that's very vividly displayed. You know, you see the brain synapses, you know, on the screen with the, firing, and you really see the graphs on the return on investment. And, you know, just seeing it all visually and hearing the parents' stories, I think, is what really makes it so powerful.
And it's happening at 5 o'clock until 7 p.m. this Monday at the 360 space downstairs here at the KTUO building.
That's right.
Kitty Blagden and Joy Lyon, anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
You can call us at 789-1235 for more information or email info@aeyc-sca.org. And thanks again to also the Alaska Children's Trust and KTIO, 360 North, and THRED for all co-sponsoring this.
Yeah, thank you so much.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 6th of February, 2015. It's the birthday of the author Michael Pollan, born Long Island, 1955, author of several books on the food industry, notably The Omnivore's Dilemma, a natural history of four meals, and also Cooked, a natural history of transformation. Michael Pollan, a big advocate of the family meal, who argues that even working couples need to figure out ways to divide household duties in such a way that makes it possible to have home-cooked family dinners. He wrote, "There's something magical that happens when people eat from the same pot. The family meal is really the nursery of democracy. It's where we learn to share. It's where we learn to argue without offending. It's just too critical to let go, as we've been so blithely doing." It's the birthday of the paleoanthropologist Mary Douglas Leakey, born in London 1913, married Louis Leakey, the anthropologist, and together they worked in Tanzania, where they discovered the fossilized bones of early humankind. 1937, on this day, John Steinbeck's novella of Mice and Men was published. He wrote it when he and his wife Carol were living in his family's vacation cottage near Monterey Bay, California. Never meant for year-round living, but he built a fireplace, closed off the porch, and they made do. His wife worked as a secretary, and Steinbeck's parents sent him an allowance of $25 a month. He wanted to write in a new style, more like a play than a novel, a book that was tightly plotted and was heavy on dialogue, ready to be adapted to the stage, about two farm workers, George and Lenny. Lenny, who's big and strong and not too bright, George, small and smart, who looks out for Lenny. Steinbeck had finished most of the book when his new puppy chewed up half the manuscript. He did not have a copy, and so he had to reconstruct it. Steinbeck said, "I was pretty mad, but the dog may have been acting critically." The book came out on this day in 1937. It got great reviews and became a big success. It's the birthday of the lexicographer Eric Partridge, born near Gisborne, New Zealand, 1894, who wrote books like A Dictionary of Slang and Unconventional English and A Dictionary of the Underworld. And it's the birthday of Tom Brokaw, born in Webster, South Dakota, 1940, who coined the phrase "the greatest generation" about the men and women who came of age in the Great Depression, served in World War II, and rebuilt the economy. Here's a poem for today by Gary Johnson, a sonnet entitled "The Lost Son." There is so very little we can do, friends, for these beautiful children of ours. They will come to grief and suffer, and you and I bow to darkness and evil powers. The gentle boy who wrote poems goes for a walk in January and does not return. His mother and father search the woods. The snow is deep. All night their hearts burn for him. He is found hanging from a limb, and the father carries the body of his son into the yard and tenderly lays him on the step. Stephen, oh darling one, see how your parents' hearts break for you. There is so very little we can do. The Lost Son by Gary Johnson, used by permission of the poet here in the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering poetry podcasts to listen to and thousands of poems to read at poetryfoundation.org, and by Progressive Insurance, working to make progress for more than 75 years. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's 31 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau and Kiernan, FM in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Next guest is here to talk about the wreck of the Princess Sophia. She's Annette Smith, and she'll be talking at the Friday Fireside Lecture at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. It happens at 6:30 and also at 8 o'clock. It's free. It's always great. Annette, thank you very much for coming down to the station today.
Thank you for having me. This is awesome.
So you tell me a little bit about the Princess Sophia.
She's an amazing ship. She's a beautiful wreck. She is also the Pacific Northwest worst marine disaster. 343 people lost their lives. There were no survivors except for one dog of that wreck. She's up on Vanderbilt Reef.
Why did it wreck?
She wrecked in a storm. In 1918, when she went down, people navigated not by GPS and radar. They had none of that. So they navigated by blowing the whistle and listening for the echoes off of the mountains. And they were in a blinding storm and couldn't see. So that was really all they had, that and a compass bearing. And somewhere in heading from Skagway towards Vancouver, somebody made a mistake, and she ended up on the reef.
But they had an opportunity to get off the ship.
Well, that's one of the controversies. There's several controversies around her, and we'll talk about some of those controversies. The official reports said there's a possibility they could have got some people off, but there would have been a great deal of lives lost if they tried to take people off. And we will look at some of the images that I have of her and look at some of the reasons why Captain Locke made the decisions that he made, which is to keep the people on board.
How big was this ship?
I'm sorry?
How big was the ship?
243 feet long, 44 feet wide.
And this is a recreational area. It's a historic site for divers.
It is.
That means you can't take anything that you find.
That is correct.
Do you have to do anything special to prepare the boat, the ship, for divers?
Well, there's a group of us just on a volunteer basis that go out in the spring and put a mooring buoy on for people that want to dive the wreck. So you can tie up, you just bring your boat up, tie up to the mooring buoy, and then you can go down the downline. But other than that, no, as far as individuals, you should be a fairly skilled diver. There's some pretty wicked currents that can come up on Vanderbilt Reef.
What kind of creatures do you see down there?
Oh, all kinds. And we'll look at some of those in the presentation. But my favorite is a prowfish. I love the prowfish down there.
Describe it, please.
They're an amazing creature. They normally live below 1,000 feet. And for some reason, they like the wreck of the Sophia, and we don't know why. But they have a really blunt face, a long, stocky body. They're large fish, kind of bug eyes, and they eat jellyfish.
We like them because they eat jellyfish.
They do eat jellyfish.
Do they eat peanut butter fish, too?
Well, you know, and probably peanut butter and jellyfish. Crunchy, of course.
Taking photos underwater and then being down, do you go down 1,000 feet?
I do not go down 1,000 feet. If I'm diving trimix, my deepest dive has been 223 feet. But the Sophia, the stern, and we'll look at the stern too, is in about 140 feet. Depending on the tide, you know, we have big tide swings. So.
What kind of stuff do you personally have to prepare as far as being a diver when you're looking at a wreck like the Princess Sophia?
Well, you know, you have your gear. We dive dry suits up here. The water's very cold. It gets, at the warmest, it's about, 45 degrees at depth, so it's pretty cold. That's pretty warm. In the winter, it gets down to about 34, so you dive with a dry suit and pretty thick quilted underwear. And then you just, you have your tank, your weights, your BC, your regulator, all the things that you need for diving anywhere. It's just a little heavier duty for up here.
What about lights? Do you need lights, artificial lights, to see what's down there?
Well, no. In fact, in the presentation, I have part of it's going to be a video of diving the wreck, and most of that is taken with ambient light. Down at the stern, there's a lot of lights that are dive lights that are used to see the prop and the rudder and that type of thing. But
how do you take pictures?
How do I take pictures?
Very carefully.
For me, I see something that I like, and I'll take several shots of it, like lots and lots of shots of it, at different angles. Prowfish, for example, I tried for years. I couldn't figure out. They're very, very shy. I couldn't figure out how to get a good shot of them. I had lots and lots of really lousy shots of them. And finally, one day, I was diving, and I had forgot to turn my light on, and they didn't run away. And when I realized they didn't have my light on, I put two and two together, and I went, these guys don't like light. And after I figured that out, I've got some amazing shots of prawfish.
Why do you dive?
I love it.
What about diving?
It is incredibly beautiful, and I love cold water diving much better than warm water diving. And not that I don't like diving in the tropics, it's pretty awesome, but it's amazing underwater here. Amazing.
Talking with Annette Smith, who's talking tonight at 6:30 and 8 o'clock at the Mindanao Glacier Visitor Center about the wreck of the Princess Sophia. What's going to be in the lecture tonight?
Well, it's kind of multi-phase. We're going to first take a look at the ship as she was. I've got a lot of shots of her in her glory days. And I've got some shots of her blueprints. And we'll take a quick look at, I picked five passengers at random. Well, one of them's not so random, but you'll find out about that person when if you come to the thing tonight, to look at a little bit of their history. And then we'll look at the story of the wreck, what happened, how it happened, through the radio transmission. So it's very real. It's not somebody else telling a story. These are the radio transmissions that went on between ships. It's for me, it's very intense. As you know, these people are all going to die through this process. And then after we go through the story of her sinking, we'll look at some slides that I've taken, stills of the wreck, and then we'll end it with a pretty awesome video diving the wreck. And I'll invite everybody along on that dive, and we'll go in about midships at the boilers and go around the stern and then come back up and around the bow, which is truly spectacular, and then back up and we'll end.
Where are there some other notable places to dive here in Southeast Alaska?
Oh, some of my favorites. Grand Island is pretty striking. It's pretty striking. We have a lot of shipwrecks here if you like wrecks. There's the state of California, which is down in Gambier Bay. Of course, the Princess Kathleen, everybody knows, is on Lena, and then the Princess Sophia in Vanderbilt, and Clara, Nevada, up on Eldred Rock. So, I have a secret wall that I really like to dive that isn't on any charts, and the Princess Sophia is ultimately my favorite, and Grand Island, and Warnowski Island down in Wrangell is another one of my absolute favorites. Warm Springs Bay. There's just anywhere you go around here is a pretty amazing place to be.
It must be an eerie feeling to know that so many people passed away and you're diving in the same area.
It's not eerie. I fell in love with the Sophia my first dive on her. The visibility was really low, so you couldn't see more than about 6 feet. And I was swimming up the center of the bow, and there's these huge plumas anemones that are big white anemones, and the flower part of them, their heads are this big around. They're huge. I'm just, radio can't see that, but really big.
That's about 3 or 4 feet.
But these things will stand up 3 to 6 feet tall, so they're huge. And you could just see them kind of in the distance waving in the current. And for me, it was like swimming through the ghosts of the ship. And I felt like I had the approval to be there.
You ever think you might run across a ghost?
I have run across ghosts. I have, actually, in a shipwreck. Yeah, but not this one.
And you're not going to talk about that tonight?
No, we're not.
Thank you very much for coming down to the station and talking about the wreck of the Princess Sophia, 6:30 and 8 o'clock at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center, absolutely free. Annette,
absolutely.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I will love you forever, my darling. My lover, Mrs. Harper, my wife. And the north wind is starting to blow in. Hold tightly, my darling, hold. Thank you. wind is starting to blow in. Hold tightly, my darling, hold tight.
Join conductor candidate Wesley Schultz and the Juno Symphony for a musical kaleidoscope of new and best-loved works, including George Gershwin's dazzling Rhapsody in Blue, featuring acclaimed pianist Johann Boetius, February 7th and 8th at JDHF. Tickets available at the Jack, Hearthside Books, and at the door, sponsored by Alaska Airlines and ConocoPhillips. For more information, visit junosymphony.org. We'll see you at the symphony.
46 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned to KTO News in Juneau, Karen and FM in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our next guest is Charles Westmoreland from the Juneau Empire and Margie Hamburger from the Juneau Douglas City Museum here to talk about tonight's show about Toe, Juneau's own cartoonist.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for coming down to the station today.
Happy to be here.
Thank you for having us.
So Tony Newman is the guy who writes all those funny cartoons in Sunday's edition of The Empire. How did you meet him?
Well, I was actually fortunate enough that I inherited Toe as our cartoonist when I came on board with The Empire in 2008. He'd already been doing it long, long before I got there. I think I was probably the third or fourth editor he'd worked with. And then when I took a little break from The Empire, came back, he was still there. So I just got lucky that I inherited a fantastic cartoonist.
How do you work as an editor and a cartoonist?
You know, he was actually very easy to work with because I had to do very little. He came up with the ideas. He hit deadline every single week. And the more that I would have tried to meddle, I think the more I would have screwed things up. So most of the time, I just sat back. We'd have conversations about local topics. On a handful of occasions, I might throw an idea his way. But a lot of it was just stepping back and letting his creative energy do what it does.
Did you ever have to say, you just can't print this?
I never did. I'm aware of one cartoon that didn't get to run, and I'd actually be happy to tell people what it is. But I'm only aware of one that actually should have published, but it didn't. And that was back during the 2010 race between Lisa Murkowski, Scott McAdams, and then Jim, I'm forgetting his name, but from Fairbanks. And it was a group of them inside of a big teacup, and the Tea Party candidate saying, come on in, the water's fine, and Lisa was sitting on the outside. And for some reason, they didn't want that cartoon to publish.
Sometimes politics are just an open field for a good cartoonist.
I think so, and especially in Juneau. In the story that we published today, he talked a little bit that in Juneau, you can find a lot of metaphors wherever you go. Snow, trees, rain, that it can all be a metaphor for something. You know, the rain can mean the budget. A tree falling over could mean the budget. So he has a lot of landscapes to work with.
And it could be the budget.
Everything can be the budget.
Margie Hamburger here to talk about Tony's show and also a reception that's happening tonight at the City Museum.
Yeah, well, you know, it's just serendipity. The museum has been collecting some of Toe's cartoons over the years and has amassed, you know, quite a few. So for one reason or another, we had it on our calendar to hang a show of some of our collection of his work. And then I've been kind of chasing after him since his work's been on our wall to, you know, do some kind of program. We've been tossing different ideas back and forth about that. But then when he decided to take this break from publishing right now, it just seemed to all be fortuitous that we could have him come and do a retrospective looking back at 20 plus years, I think, of cartooning in the capital city. And not only at the Empire, but some of the other papers, and also an opportunity for us all, us community members who've been avid followers, to kind of celebrate his presence among us.
How many cartoons did you get to look at?
Did he look at?
Did he look at to determine what you want to put in the show?
Oh, yeah. Well, I was talking with him last night. He said he had about 1,000 published cartoons, and he narrowed it down to 50. So we're going to see 50 that he's going to show us tonight. Oh, and I should just mention the time. So we're going to do this right at the tail end of First Friday. So the museum is open for First Friday, as we usually are. And then at the tail end at 7 o'clock, we'll quickly get all the chairs set up and get Toe up in front there, and we'll have the program begin around then.
Giles, do you have a favorite cartoon?
You know, there's a couple that really stick out to me. I can go with one of the more recent ones. I really appreciate the cartoon that he did right after the election, when we had very close races between the Senate and also the governor's race. And it was a cartoon of Mark Begich on the TV saying, "I'm not going to concede until every vote is counted." And then you see a cartoon of the governor, Bill Walker, saying, Governor Bill Walker, Senator Dan Sullivan saying, "Come on, just give up already." And then you see Parnell on the side of them saying, "Hold on, guys, he's got a point." And I appreciated that because during the 2 weeks that followed the election, you had Republicans saying, you know, Begich just needs to give up. But they weren't saying anything about the Republican governor. And it was the same way for the other side. So it was a little ironies like that that I've always appreciated.
But it could have been the budget.
It could have been the budget. But there were no trees in this one.
But there might have been ravens. That's one of my favorite things about, you know, his signature raven that he uses as a commentary often to talk on the side. And we have actually, the museum does have on the wall right now a couple of raven stories, actually four of them, that are, again, part of our collection, where he collected raven stories from various community members and did sort of story cartoons. So that's something that I don't think he's published in the Empire, so that might be a little bit unfamiliar to people, but it's on the wall right now.
I know he has a book out of him making fun of Sarah Palin.
Right.
A lot of material there.
Yeah. And he was talking to me last night when we were going over the program about, you know, which politicians and public figures are fun and easier to draw and how some of them are a little bit more challenging just because of the kind of features they might have on their face or the expressions that they make. And he's going to talk about that tonight, but also talk about a lot of the other kinds of themes that he has on in his work. The weather, of course, is a big one. Sometimes just when it's not the budget, it's just about snow or rain. And, of course, he's so loved for his ability to memorialize the passing of very significant people in our community. And that's been something that I've loved to see, sort of as that the whole community can together feel that sadness and recognize it. And he usually seems to be able to nail it in such a lovely, lovely way.
So there's an opening tonight for First Friday, and then there's a talk at 7 o'clock.
Right, and we have other exhibits. We have right now at the museum the Ordinary Things, Extraordinary Tales exhibit, which is also a community exhibit featuring selections from our collection of that were done by 12 different community members, and they've each written a personalized label about that. So that's a really fun show, and we have one more month of that. So people can come and browse and either stay until Toe gets there or go wander around to other venues and come back at 7 to hear the program.
And you get the 12 by 12 show.
Oh, yes. Thank you. Thank you. We do have the 12 by 12. So a couple other things coming up. Let me first talk about next week. We have the 2 days when there's parent-teacher conferences, and so if people are looking for a place to park their kids, we have hands-on history days happening on Thursday and Friday of next week, and registration is online or available at the museum. And people can learn about that on our website or give us a call. And then the other thing that's fast approaching is the 12 by 12, and that'll open up in March. This will be the 11th year of that exhibit, where all comers, any artist or creative person who wants to submit, as long as it fits the guidelines of being no larger than 12 inches in any direction. That includes the frame. And also our theme this year is H2O color. So you can interpret that as watercolor, or you can interpret it chemically, or however you want to.
And the deadline for that is?
The deadline, the last week in February, we're accepting, the 24th, is that right? Week of the 24th is when those are come into the museum, and there's a submission form, and it does cost $12.12 to submit a piece of the 12 by 12.
So he's been a notable figure. All right, Margie Hamburger and Charles Westmoreland, thank you for coming by. Is there anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
Well, it won't be ready for tonight in time for the presentation, but I've decided that I'm going to take some of Toto's best cartoons, and we're going to start publishing some slideshows over the years so we can put together 2014 and going on back as far as we can. So people can get a little bit of a – they'll only get 50 cartoons tonight. We'll give them a few hundred to look at JunoEmpire.com.
All right. Thanks very much for coming down. Appreciate
thank you.
That. And thank you for publishing all those great cartoons over the years.
It's been my pleasure, and it's my hope that when Toe's ready to retire from his current gig, I think we'll see him back one day.
Mm-hmm.
Until then, I'm going to keep the position open.
All right. Thanks for coming by.
This is Bird Note. It's a calm winter morning. The lake is still. What is that sound? Ah, the cackling, grunting, and croaking of American coots calling to one another. Coots are plump, chicken-like water birds, very dark gray. They settle onto lakes and estuaries, forming rafts of hundreds, even thousands of birds. They like to feed on aquatic vegetation, and sometimes they lumber ashore to nibble at grasses and agricultural crops. Here come a few now. Check out the yellow-orange legs and feet. Look carefully, and you'll see an unusual adaptation, not the usual webs. Instead, coots have lobed toes to help them swim and maneuver underwater. Although they are excellent swimmers, coots are awkward and clumsy flyers. To get airborne, they require long running takeoffs. There are some now, trying to take flight, flapping their wings and slapping their lobed toes against the surface of the water. All that effort usually produces only short flights, within 20 feet of the surface. Already, they're settling back onto the water. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Come join us for the Gold Street Music Concert on Saturday, February 7th at 7:30 at Resurrection Lutheran Church. The musicians performing will be Keith Heller, Deb Spence, and Joe Emerson, Patricia Hall and Riley Woodford, Mark Hurd, Cray Van Kirk, Patrick Murphy, and Friends. That's Gold Street Music on Saturday, February 7th, at 7:30 at Resurrection Lutheran Church. Tickets at the door.
Juno Jazz and Classics proudly presents one of the greatest violinists of our time, Midori. In concert one night only, February 10th, 7:30 p.m. at the JDHS Auditorium. Violin virtuoso Midori will perform masterworks by Beethoven, Bach, Strauss, and others. Tickets available at jazzandclassics.org, The Jack, or Hearthside Books. This concert, in cooperation with Partners in Performance, benefits the 2015 Jazz and Classics Festival. Don't miss the one and only Midori.
You are tuned to KTMO News in Juneau and KRNN FM in Juneau. Next Monday on Juneau afternoon, Scott Burton will be your host. We'll get the details on Wednesday's Mudrooms event. We'll learn what it takes to become a certified balloon artist with guest Kathy Buell. Aaron Harrington will be here to highlight the King of Fish balloon drop. And we'll learn about an upcoming deadline for a Rasmussen Individual Artist Grant with guest Jason Smart. Thanks for tuning in to Juneau afternoon today.
This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. We also rebroadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K210AF.